Hello, welcome to the first Behind the Headlines podcast with me, Hannah Storm.
And me, John Crowley. In these podcasts, we'll be talking to journalists, many of them household names, about their stories, the challenges they face, and how they sometimes struggle to make sense of it all. Hannah and I are both directors of Headlines Network and longtime journalists.
Journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in. But as we're frequently told, never become the story, which, as we'll hear, can often be hard.
For this episode, we spoke with Lindsay Hilson, the international editor for Channel 4 News, and Lise Doucette, the BBC's chief international correspondent. They've been friends for a long time and agreed to speak with us for this special conversation in memory of another dear journalist friend, Marie Colvin, who died a decade ago this week.
As well as this being a tribute to one of the most extraordinary journalists of recent times, this is also a conversation between friends, one where they reminisced on memories of stories covered and what really lies at the heart of journalism, its people. We recorded this podcast at the beginning of February, and we started by talking about the fact that Lise and Lindsay had just returned from Ukraine, exactly the kind of place Marie would have been.
Marie would have been in the snowiest, nastiest, muddiest, most rat-infested trench of all, whereas actually I spent most of the time in Kiev, where it was rather pleasant, if I may say.
We also have to say that Lindsay and I are back in London, and Marie would still be there because she worked for a Sunday newspaper. And so not only was it the thrill of the chase for the story, she had to get a story that no one else got. So she was often the first to arrive and the last to leave. And could I please interrupt this and say, Lindsay Hilson and I are not just journalists, we're very good friends. And we don't compete with each other. Don't tell that to our bosses, though. And I think maybe that's a really important reason why we stay sane and why we agreed to do this podcast together.
Yeah, because we're sort of journalistic twins, because I started off as the BBC East Africa underpaid, overworked stringer, and Lee started off as the BBC West Africa overworked, underpaid stringer. So we've been sort of joined at the hip across a continent from pretty early on.
They tried very hard to get rid of us. And could I just say that we are journalistic twins, but I'm a little bit younger than Lindsay. I think it might actually...
I'm older and wiser. True.
Three and a half months, maybe. But I just... Hashtag just saying. But we are journalistic twins.
She's quite immature, I think you'll find.
Well, thank you so much. And I mean, can I just say as well that I've worked with both of you in the past, and I worked briefly with Marie as well at the Sunday Times, and both you are role models to me, and I'm hugely grateful that you're on this podcast with us talking about Marie's legacy. So I'm just going to ask you briefly how you met. Talk to us about what your first impressions were of Marie when you both met her.
Well, I'll go first. I met her, I mean, I knew about her reputation and so on, and I had seen her, but we first really met and became friends in 1998, and there was a war between Eritrea and Ethiopia, and everyone was trying to get to Eritrea. I say everyone was trying to get to Eritrea. Of course, all the sensible people were trying to get out of Eritrea, but the journalists were trying to get in. And so we went to Djibouti, which was and is the hottest place on earth, because there were these Ukrainians who were flying business people out of Asmara and flying journalists in. And Marie and I kind of walked across the tarmac together to this rickety plane, and it was so hot, it was, you know, the tarmac was sort of melting before our eyes. Anyway, we got chatting to each other and we sat next to each other, and as the plane started to taxi along, something went past the window, and we realized that it was our pilots' t-shirts, because it was so hot that they had taken them off, their sweaty t-shirts, and hung them on the wings and forgotten to put them back on again. So we looked into the cockpit, and yes, the door was open, and sure enough, these enormous Ukrainian pilots were flying bare-chested. And then at that moment, the plane took off, and as it went up, all the TV equipment, which they had failed to secure at the front of the plane, started to slide down the aisle past us. And at this point, we got the giggles so much, we were like two little girls in class. I mean, we were sure we were going to plunge to our deaths, but we just laughed and laughed. And, you know, in the 14 years I knew her after that, we didn't ever really stop giggling.
Now I've got imposter syndrome. How can I actually match that story? God, Channel 4 is doing better than the BBC on this.
You said we weren't competitive.
Well, Once upon a time, not so long ago, I was based in the Middle East, and so was Marie Colvin. So Marie Colvin was my neighbor, my friend, a colleague, and someone who ran in the same circles as I did, all chasing the same story day in, day out. And Jerusalem was the place to be based, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the 1990s never left the headlines. And there was Marie Colvin, always with a whiff of danger and a whiff of glamour about her. She knew Yasser Arafat. She knew Colonel Gaddafi. She knew everyone it was important to know, and she knew all of us. She would always be the life of the party, not only having the with her gorgeous American drawl, the funniest stories, the longest drag on the cigarette, the best shoes. Some of us would show up with our flat-heeled shoes. We even took pictures of our shoes because Marie's shoes were so great. So she was, in a sense, a girl's girl, a journalist, in a time when journalism really mattered in that part of the world. Marie Colvin mattered, and she made her mark. But when I say that she was a girl's girl, it's like Lindsay and I. We were all part of the sorority of journalists. I don't even think we thought, I don't know, Lindsay, what do you think? We didn't really think of ourselves as women correspondents. I remember Lindsay came to visit one time, and I still remember sitting on cushions in my flat in Jerusalem, overlooking the old city of Jerusalem, overlooking Damascus Gate. Did we think of ourselves as women journalists? I mean, now we tend to be thought of as women journalists, but certainly there were women journalists there, and Marie really, really stood out. And I was proud to call her both a colleague as well as a friend.
I think that's a really interesting point, because I actually think that this sort of consciousness about, oh, we're women, oh my God, there are women on the front line, I think that that is something that has come more recently, and I'm not sure that it's very healthy. And I think, yeah, in those days, yeah, obviously, you know, though. I think that there was a thing, you know, there were more men, and actually it's better now in the sense that there are more young women now than there were when we started off. Though I always say I think that that's because being a correspondent, particularly in the Middle East, has become a poorly paid, caring profession. But yeah, we didn't really think about it, did we? We just got on with it. And certainly Marie just got on with it.
Lindsay, you document Marie's life and times in your biography of her in Extremis. The book is a tribute to a dear friend, clearly, and her towering journalism, but it's by no means hagiography, is it, as well?
No, I mean, I think there would have been no point in writing a paean of praise. Marie was full of flaws. I mean, oh my God, so many flaws. She drank far too much. She had the most rackety life. She smoked like a chimney, used to drive me crazy. She had loads of affairs and was always in some, you know, she was always in some state of heartbreak. And she, arguably, she was reckless. And I know that one of the things that you want to talk about on this podcast is about mental health. Well, I think that Marie's tale is in many ways it's exemplary, but in other ways it's cautionary, because she did not take enough care of either her mind or her body. And that, I think, is one of the things I wanted to bring out in the book. And, you know, lots of young journalists write to me who've read the book and say, oh my God, she was so amazing. And I'm saying, yeah, but don't be like Marie. Don't be like Marie. And, you know, don't take too many risks, because she did.
You've written before about the myth of Marie, haven't you? And you've written before about the risks that she took. I'm conscious that, Lise, you were on Desert Island Discs recently, and you spoke about the fact that no story is worth dying for, but some stories are worth taking risks for. How do you find that kind of fine line between taking the risk but then taking too much risk?
Actually, the addendum to that is you often know the risks before it's too late, and that is the Marie Colvin story, going in not just once and coming back, but going in twice to the besieged city of Homs, where they were coming under fire. And Paul Conroy, her brave, brilliant camera person who went with her, saying, and it was in his film, saying, you know, I didn't feel right. Journalists often talk about this. It's not enough to save you, but we do fall back on these talismans and this, you know, the feeling in your gut. It just didn't feel right. But yet Marie said, I'm going, I'll go without you. And he went, even though every bone in his body was saying, you know, don't go back in. Journalism is always one more step, one more interview, one more night in that cafe, one more attempt to go back to try for that interview. And often it's the one more that is the risk too far. The person who came up with that expression, that there are risk stories worth taking risk for, was Anthony Shadid. And he wrote about it. And a week later, he was dead of an asthma attack in Syria. And then a week later, Marie was dead, killed by a mortar fired at the house where she was staying.
That was a terrible week.
It was a terrible time. It was all the journalistic community took a deep breath. You know, I'm sitting in my office at home, and I can still remember my desk was on the other side of the room, and I was sitting in this chair, and I remember Lindsay calling me, and the two of us in floods of tears. Marie's dead.
It was the worst day ever. And actually, for about a year after that, I really couldn't go anywhere dangerous at all. And I'm lucky at Channel 4 News because I have very understanding editors. And I went to my editor and I said, look, you know, I just can't for a bit. You're just going to have to let me have a bit of a break from this kind of reporting. And he said, that's absolutely fine. You don't ever have to go back and do that kind of reporting again if you don't want to. But if you do, just let me know. And so I did other kinds of things. And then I did want to go back about a year later. But certainly, it was such a blow. And I think, and also for me, it was because I had had dinner with her in Beirut just about a week before. And, you know, and again, I tell this story in the book. There were three of us with Marie at that dinner: Jim Muir of the BBC, Neil McFarquhar of New York Times, myself, and then Marie. And the three of us said, no, it's too dangerous to go in, to be smuggled across the border and to go through this sewage tunnel. They had to walk through a sewage tunnel for a kilometre to get to Babarama. And then, quite apart from, you know, what actually killed her, and we should also say killed Remy Oschlick, a young French photographer who was
Syrians.
And badly injured Paul Conray and Edith Bouvier, another French journalist with Le Figaro. You know, there was a danger of being kidnapped. Another colleague of ours, Paul Wood from the BBC, and his team and Fred Scott had been kidnapped a few weeks earlier on that. And so the three of us, Jim and Neil and I, were like, no, this is just too dangerous. And Marie said, anyway, it's what we do.
Is it what we do? Is it really what we do? Is it the sense of kind of this need to run towards danger? Or is it the sense that perhaps sometimes our ability to compute what is normal, our parameters get shifted because of the pressures we exist under?
Yeah, look, what is, I learned, my partner Tim quite often says to me, don't confuse yourself for someone who is normal. And so he has a point, because obviously the things that we do are not, most people wouldn't do that. Most people wouldn't, you know, go to Syria. Most people in this country anyway wouldn't go to Syria in the first place. And of course, that, to us, it's normal. That's what we do. We're foreign correspondents. That's what we do when we cover wars. That's what we do. But it's about the judgments. And I think the judgments are extremely difficult. And certainly Marie's judgments would be very different to mine. And Marie had taken many risks in her career, which I did not take and would not have taken. And I also think it's one of the things which I enjoy about working in television, because I'm always working with a camera operator and a producer. And, you know, you work things out between the three of you. And as a newspaper correspondent, she was often on her own, sometimes with a photographer, but, you know, quite often on her own. So nobody to bounce those ideas off with. And then also, I think you have kind of rhythms between you. I remember in Libya, the civil war in Libya after the revolution in 2011, they staged it very conveniently along the main road, which was very nice. And so you could drive up to the front line and film for a bit, and then you could drive back to Benghazi. And it was always the issue of how far will you go? And I would always say, oh, let's go a bit further. And my producer, Sarah, would say, let's not. And so that enabled me to pretend to be a little bit braver than I really was, safe in the knowledge that Sarah wouldn't let me do it. And I think that sometimes in a team you can build up, and that's quite healthy, you know, whereas I think Marie quite often didn't have those kind of breaks on her.
Lindsay is so right to talk about the family we work with. It's the family we travel with when we go to countries to tell the stories. But our family, our cousins on the ground, make all the difference.
The local journalists that we're working
with. Local, yeah. It is, they, the eyes and the ears, and it's not just the journalists, it's the drivers, it's the friends. It's because they will always, no matter how much time we spend in a country, they will always know more than us. And often we will work with the same people time and again. You have each other's backs. And time and again, when something traumatic has happened, we have talked about it. We've reflected on it. We keep talking about it. You make jokes about it. You have reflections on it. And for me, this has been one of the best ways of dealing with traumatic events. Because as outsiders, we know that as hard as it is for us, it is immeasurably harder for our colleagues on the ground who will have to live with that for all of their days.
And obviously then there's also the issue of people in London, and certainly at Channel 4 News, and I think with the BBC as well. There's much more consciousness, both of mental health issues and of physical danger, than there used to be. And we're not sort of left on our own to make those decisions anymore. And they tend to err on the side of caution.
Your book is a tribute also to Sarah, who you call another companion on the road. And she was a colleague of mine at Channel 4 News as well. And I just wanted to kind of think a little bit about that sense of community that stems from journalism. You've already talked about how close you are as friends, and I appreciate, Lise, you want to say something, but it's just that sense of people hold us back in some ways, but sometimes in good ways as well, don't they?
There was this expression that we started using when I was first started covering the war in Afghanistan, where we would say the most courageous person is the person who says, I'm not going on that helicopter gunship. I'm not going on that trip. And that person who would look all his colleagues and competitors who were going on that helicopter, who were going to take that road trip, even though you are all so acutely aware of the possible risks which could lie ahead. I'll just make this one comment. You know, there's something about journalism. You know, if you want to say one of the essences of being a journalist is to be positive or kind about it. You can say, we're curious. We always want to go as far as we can go and for as long as we can go. But it's, on the other level, it's something that's very physical. We talked about this feeling in the gut in your stomach. There's this thing which I call a pang. Something happens. You hear something, you know, there's been a coup in West Africa. There's been a major development there's a possible war in Ukraine. And it hits you in your gut and you think, I've got to be there. That's the story's happening. I've got to be there. And yes, sometimes, you know, Lindsay and I often call each other. What do you think? We spoke about, you know, should we be in Afghanistan or should we be in the Middle East? We talked about Ukraine. When do you think Ukraine can happen? Using a sounding board, and obviously I talk to my colleagues and Lindsay talks to her colleagues. And yes, in the field, as television journalists, we're always, although now we've got VJs who sometimes go on their own, but it's not to be encouraged, video journalists who can do everything. It's really important, especially in areas of risk, to have someone who has your back and someone who has your ear. First of all, to make those decisions, there's really, really hard decisions. And we do have this mantra, if one person says, I'm not going, then no one is going. You cannot go into an area of greater risk. You're probably already in an area of risk with someone who says it doesn't feel right. So you say, right, we're not going. No story is worth it. So yes, we do. We've got to fight against this pang in our stomach, which says, I want to be there. Because it's about, there's no comparison for on the ground in the heat and the dust and face to face. That is what journalism is about. Now, we can do it remotely, but it's just not the same. And it's just not the same quality, caliber and of journalism.
No, it isn't. And that was what Marie utterly believed in. She believed in being an eyewitness, as we do. But I go back to that road in Libya, and I think that every time I went up that road, I felt like a fool. And every time I didn't, I felt like a coward. And that was quite a complicated thing. And Sarah, the producer who Hannah was also mentioning, who was I was very, very close to, and who tragically died of cancer, she you know, the sort of closeness that you get that she and I had and that I have with, you know, camera operator who I work with, Soren, you know, the closeness, these are your traveling family. And they are as important to me in many ways as my other friends or my family. They're my on the road family. And, you know, you go through a lot together. You go through experiences with them that you don't with anybody else. And that is very intense. And it's rather marvelous, you know, actually. It's a kind of closeness that I think we love. And it means, certainly to me, it means an awful lot.
Lise and Lindsay, you've both carried on her legacy by setting up the Marie Colvin Network. Can you explain a little bit more about its mission and work?
Well, no one wants someone to die in vain. No one wants the legacy of someone to be forgotten. And it wasn't just us, myself, Lindsay, and Jane Wellesley, who was one of Marie's closest friends, not a journalist, but a documentary maker, a writer. And, you know, we felt this, that there was a great sense at her memorial, at her funeral, that somehow, you know, a Marie-ness had to carry on, because Marie didn't do just good journalism. She was a very good colleague in the field. And we know she was good to us. She was good to journalists just starting out. Many of them spoke of how Marie had helped them along the way, whether it was a tip for a story, a hair band to hold back their hair in Libya. There was always something. So we did come up with this idea, and it could have taken many forms. It could have been for something for men and women. It could have been for many parts of the world. But we decided to focus on the area where Marie worked most of all, and that was the Middle East. And partly because of the community of women journalists in the Middle East who had certain vulnerabilities, huge challenges, both security, professional, personal, that a lot of them felt more comfortable that if it was for women. So that's how the Marie Colvin Journalistic Network came about. And it was, first of all, allied to the Circle. So Marie can tell us. Lindsay, here we are. Marie's with us. Lindsay can tell you about that part of it.
Yeah, so I mean, basically, The Circle is a charity which is set up by the singer Annie Lennox, and Marie had met her before her death, and Annie had been keen to do something. So we started off this support network for female journalists in the Arab world, Arab journalists, and we felt it was very important that it should be in Arabic, and it should not be, you know, for not really people like us, but for this growing community of mainly young female journalists wanting to tell the stories of their own countries. Anyway, so we started off as a project of The Circle, and now we're about to become a fully fledged charity ourselves. We've been going 5 years now. And we have, I think we have 250 members or something like that. And we provide mentorship. We provide hostile environment training. We provide mental health support. We provide help when we can with getting articles placed. We provide emergency grants. And so these are women, you know, Libyan women, Syrian women, Egyptian women who, you know, it's not, you think about life being hard for a journalist like Marie, but think about some of these women. Their families don't want them to be journalists. The government doesn't want them to be a journalist. Nobody wants them to be a journalist, but they're driven to do this thing. And so we're there to try and support and help them. And, you know, I'm very proud of it. I'm very proud of our members because, you know, some of them have gone on and have won awards and have got great jobs with, you know, outlets like, you know, we've had photographers working for the New York Times now, and others who, you know, are doing great work in Arabic, others who are doing work in English. You know, as one who was my mentee, who's on the ground in Sudan, incredibly brave, reporting for various newspapers. And so it's quite a low-key project. I just hope that we can give them a little bit of support here and there in the way that Marie used to give young journalists support here and there, and that can keep them going and help them on their way.
It sounds like that sense of solidarity and cooperation is so critical and so helpful. And I know that you say it's quite a low-key project, but I would imagine it makes a vast difference to the lives of a lot of journalists in that region. So thank you for sharing that. I just want to ask you a question.
Let me just mention, because just how meaningful, profoundly meaningful it is that, and this goes not through Lindsay and Jane and I, but through Dima and Abir and Pippa, literally handholding.
They're the people who actually run the network. We just take the glory. They actually do the work.
But there's been, you know, obviously, we won't say the names or the countries, but there has been more surprising degree that sort of surprised all of us, that month after month that women call up literally with danger at the door. They're being chased. They've been arrested. Their family is under pressure. Something really terrible has happened. They've got to run. They need to hide. They need financial support. And Dima Hamdan often is literally holding their hands across the miles and connecting our network with other media watchdogs, others around the world who can provide financial support, consular support, trauma support. It's extraordinary to see that. And it's just really, really heartwarming that the network has been there time and again. And sometimes it's just connecting the dots, connecting all these organizations together. Sometimes it's a bit of financial support. And sometimes it's just that reassuring voice at the end of the line. Don't worry. Don't worry. We're going to help you. Don't be scared. We're going to be there for you. Because these are all incredibly courageous women, but they often work in incredibly dangerous circumstances.
And feel very isolated.
Mm.
Isolation is a really important point in terms of mental health. We know that a lot of journalists feel incredibly isolated by poor mental health. And actually, a lot of the time, as we heard before, people feel pushed in some ways to go and cover stories. People feel like they can't speak about their own experiences. Now, that conversation has changed a lot in the last 10 years. And I'm really struck by that. But I think we probably all know people who feel like they've been pushed a little bit. How do we, as friends, as a community of empathetic people, how do we support our colleagues who are struggling, would you say?
But I think that's a really difficult issue, because if you take Marie, who did suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, particularly after her eye was shot in Sri Lanka and she lost the sight in it, which was obviously the most incredibly traumatic experience. Not, you know, the losing of the sight is traumatic, but the way it happened and lying there in a field and having to get up and saying, I'm a journalist, and then being shot and going over and over in her mind that moment, you know, was very traumatizing for her. There's a whole issue about, you know, did she feel pushed? And there are many people who said and who still believe that the Sunday Times pushed her too hard. But many of the people closest to her would say Marie was the one who pushed herself. You couldn't stop her. Now, you can have an argument which says that your editor should stop you. And I understand that. But I think often we are the ones who push ourselves, because this is a profession that attracts very ambitious and determined people. And so I personally have never felt that I was pushed into doing anything by my employers or anybody else. It's always me doing the pushing and then me doing the pulling and the pushing and the pulling. And I want to go and I don't dare. And you know, and should I go or shouldn't I go? And, you know, and all of this kind of stuff. And then cursing myself for not going or for leaving too early. So it's all my own stuff. It's not my editors. I don't know what you think about that, Lise.
Well, it's back to what I said, the pang, that sort of feeling that hits you in the stomach that says, you know, I want to be there. And it's not even like this crude wanting to be on air. It's just that this is the kind of life that you lead, that these are not just stories for us, that we're not just thinking, oh, I must go to what's happening because I will be on the news that night. It's also you think, oh my God, what's happening to this person? Is this person going to be okay? I want to be there when something bad or something good is happening. You just want to be there when something is happening, because that place is part of your life too. You've followed it. You've walked in that history for so long that when something happens, you want to be there. But on isolation, this is such an important point. And I think it really is incumbent upon those of us who have the luxury of working for so well-resourced organizations and working with great teams, that when we're on the ground, and you can see there's often, if we're going to talk women journalists, but not just both women and men, you can see the journalists, the local journalists, hi, how are you? I'm Lise. Who are you? You know, often now everyone wants selfies. So you take selfies, but just
only with you because you're so famous, not with me.
No, but it's you know, people sometimes they don't even know who you are.
Darling, they know, everybody knows who you are.
The It's just the sense that of, you use the word solidarity, Hannah. I think we have our, you know, in the Middle East, we call wasta, that if we can, by being with them, it's to tell them, hey, we're colleagues. We're in this together. You're a journalist. We're a journalist. We work for different organizations, but we're working together. And often they can be more helpful to us than we can be to them. But that sense of it's, I think it really matters. I know when I was starting out, both Lindsay and I starting out, if someone we saw who was more experienced than us, who we knew from, it makes a difference. You know, the Persians have this expression about the tree that has the greatest fruit has to bend the lowest. In other words, just put out your hand and help. But of course, that help can go much deeper. If that, if you, a person senses that you're supportive, that you're open, that you kind, the basic most important of human emotions, you're kind, maybe they'll open up to you. I feel a little bit nervous. This person's giving me trouble. Do you mind if I go with you? I see it as one of our responsibilities in this time, because one of the best developments in our time is that there's a whole new generation of journalists from the countries we cover. And a lot of them are women, it has to be said, telling their own stories. And we have to help those stories happen and have to help them be heard. It's really
important.
Can I
ask one question off the back of that? Lindsay, you say in Extremis that Marie was easy to love, but hard to help. And whatever your walk of life, we probably all know someone like that. But does journalism have a problem in general in terms of recognising colleagues who are suffering from poor mental health?
I don't know. I think that there are certainly, there's a complicated thing, isn't there, about people who want privacy. I mean, certainly with Channel 4 News and ITN, we have a hotline. So if you come back from somewhere where something awful has happened or you've seen something awful, or, you know, even if you haven't, it's just what you feel, you can ring this line and it's confidential and that is available to everybody. It doesn't mean that you want to tell your colleagues you've done that, do you? I mean, being confidential is a very important part of it. So there are two things. There's the being, you know, nobody wants anybody to be isolated, but at the same time, people have the right to confidentiality. And if they are having, issues or problems and they want to deal with that without bearing their soul to their colleagues, that should be fine as well. And so I think there's a bit of a line there. And I do also think that it's an issue about colleagues sometimes more than bosses, or you might, feel more easy to reveal something or talk to a colleague than you would to a boss. But I know that people say this, that there is that people don't always feel that they can express what they feel and so on, but I'm not sure whether journalism is worse than any other parallel kind of walk of life. Because if you think of other kind of jobs where part of the job is to run towards danger, whether that's the police or the military or firefighters or whatever, most of the people who do this are going to be quite resilient until they're not. But they're going to be the certain kinds of personality which are drawn to that kind of job. And I don't know that journalism is worse than any other in people feeling that they can't maybe talk in public about it.
And I think a lot of the stigma, I think there's much less now. There's a much greater awareness of stigma. You know, the classic stereotype that journalists get drunk and that's how they deal with the stresses of their job. I can think of some young journalists, both men and male and female, who actually talk openly on social media, on Instagram, on Twitter, about their mental health, because it helps them. And then they get, for the most part, reassurance. People encourage them. Well done for speaking out. I feel the same thing.
Oh my God, I would rather poke my eye out with a sharp stick than do that. I cannot think of anything worse. I mean, it is so not my generation. I think God, the very idea of bearing oneself in that way, it's just awful.
I want to go back to a word that you used at the beginning, Hannah, which is role model. And I think all of us, we want to see representations in public life of people we admire, we aspire to be. But I think it's really important, and this is an important part of mental health, that just trying to be yourself and a better version of yourself. Don't try to be someone else. So when it comes to mental health, some people deal with it, they want to deal with it very publicly. So Lindsay and I may not, in fact, we don't put, not that we have, you know, these kind of really deep traumatic issues to splash across social media, to discuss across social media. But some people decide that's the best way for them to deal with. If it works for them, then they should do it. If it doesn't work, if people, some people prefer to deal with it privately, by a diary, by a therapist, or with their team, then that's their choice. I think there is no one size fits all when it comes
but
to...
But I do, but I have a slight problem with all this sort of very public stuff, because I sometimes I feel that we're sort of almost pushed into saying, well, we all must be traumatized, you know. And I think, oh my God, I'm such a hard-hearted old cow, because I'm not. But actually, when you look at it, and it's really interesting when you read the literature on it, you know, Anthony Feinstein, who's done the a lot of work on mental health and journalism, the majority of us are resilient. And I think that, and majority of us are not traumatized. And the other thing, which I think is really important, is that a lot of the people who do have mental health problems or suffer from PTSD, particularly after, you know, seeing or experiencing particularly dreadful things, do and can recover. And I think that that is really important. It's not, you know, you're not sentenced for life to this, and you can carry on and do your job. And then I think that the other thing, which I've read a little bit about, and you guys, John and Hannah, would know more than me about this, is this idea of post-traumatic growth. Because I do also think, and I have to put this carefully, because it's not that I enjoy seeing terrible things. I don't. I hate it. And I get very upset at the things that I see and the suffering I witness. But I do also think that that sharing of other people's stories is a tremendous privilege. And I do also feel incredibly grateful when I come home and I'm so lucky. And I feel that I've been very privileged to lead the life I have done, which has involved a lot of travel and a lot of finding out about all these experiences that people have had. And it's very sobering, and it has made me appreciate what I've got. I don't know what you think about that, Lise.
You were speaking about gratitude, Lise, on Desert Island Discs. You were speaking about coming home as well. And the sense, I was going to ask you about this. You spent last year quite a lot of time in Afghanistan, a place that is very close to your heart. And then you came home at the end of the year. And perhaps that's a kind of way of looking at what Lindsay's just said in terms of coming home and kind of settling back into normality, but also feeling that immense privilege.
You know, they often say about war that it clarifies everything. Everything is in such sharp relief. Your emotions are the most raw. And so that when you see something that turns yourself inside out and upside down, which pains you, and often this doesn't involve strangers in the mix of people, the stories you're covering, there's friends and fellow travelers. And when you go through this and you feel so pain for them and you come out of it, suddenly all the things in life, like coming home, being able to come home. And I felt this about home because on August the 15th, and since then, so many Afghan friends have left their country, left so much of who they were, their dreams and aspirations behind, and left their country never knowing if they would ever return to their country again, whether their country was their own. And for me, just going home, I thought, my God, I can go home. This is such a gift. So it was thrown, you know, when we always appreciate going home after a tough assignment. But even more so now, when time and again, many of the conflicts we see in the Middle East, they are zero-sum games. We have Lebanese friends who feel they've lost their country, Iraqi friends. It is really the kinds of conflicts now would seem to burn so much to the ground. And so when you come out of this, it's often people, there's this expression, oh, don't you feel guilty going to a cafe? Don't you feel guilty? No, I don't. We should celebrate. We should cherish those things that so many around the world are deprived of. And perhaps that is one way, if you read the literature, and again, I'll say, like Lindsay, you and John Hannah are greater experts than us, that it reinforces that sense in you that what you have is so important that you have to hold on to it, that you haven't lost what you have just witnessed so viscerally in someone else's life.
But I would say something else, and Lise will get pissed off with me about this. But also, the thing about Afghanistan, a lot of those people who Lise knows, the only reason they've been able to leave and go somewhere safe is because she has helped them. And I think that that is a very, it's true, and you can't say anything because I know. But I think it's a very complicated thing. For me, it's one of the most complicated things, is that when you step over the line from telling people's stories to becoming instrumental in them. And I think in Afghanistan, that was one of those places where it became very, very difficult. Now, for me, I don't know Afghanistan very well, but I had a couple of people who I was connected with who I tried to help and am helping get out. Lise has
a lot of our friends, Emma Green, Harrison, Melissa, Fong, Anuanan, Rosita, that so many... sometimes there are stories that go far beyond just the telling of the news of that day, that people's lives have been so ripped apart that not to try and stop to help put a little bit back of it together would seem to be heartless and cruel. You couldn't...
But it's one of the difficult things, isn't it, Lise, is because you had so many demands and you couldn't help everybody. I mean, just because you couldn't. And I think that that's what, I think that was one of the toughest things about that time, was I know that you helped so many people and you tried to help people, but you can't help everybody. And that is really, really difficult, isn't it?
Actually, this may be a good point to come in. We are going to have to wrap up, unfortunately. We could go on and on. This has been a fantastic conversation. But just to wrap up, a decade on from Marie's death, what would you both say that we've learned? How can we cherish her memory? What can journalism as a sector, as an industry, as a group of people take forward from her memory?
I'd say to continue to believe in the things that she believed in, which were speaking up for the underdog and being there as an eyewitness and telling the truth and not sitting behind your computer and looking at things long distance and going, on the one hand this and on the other hand that. Actually being out there and doing the proper reporting. But also just being conscious of that line, because the real tragedy that we're talking about is the fact that Marie is not here. And Marie is no longer here to tell the story. And she's no longer able to do that amazing journalism that she did. And so, you know, the importance of stopping and stepping back and sometimes saying, you know, this risk is just too much and there is a limit to what I can do.
I think Marie reminds us, journalism matters. Telling the stories of our time matter. And there's no alternative to on the ground, face to face, in the heat and dust kind of journalism, when you are there in every sense of the word. But journalism doesn't matter as much as taking care of ourselves as individuals. We have to protect journalism, but we also have to protect the journalists. And that if you are not as good and strong as you can be, then your journalism will not. And it's all right to stop for a while. I think it's really important. Journalists live in this rarefied life that we're always in the fast lane, not in the margins of history, but marching right in the middle. We live such a privileged life. But sometimes we just have to go back to the life where we walk in the park, smell the flowers, drink a cup of tea, just be yourself.
Lise Doucet and Lindsay Hilsum, thank you very much for joining us both.
You're welcome. It was hard to shut us up, wasn't it?
But you know what? All good things must come to an end. What a conversation, though. It really was two friends of old reminiscing, wasn't it, John? And such a great tribute to the memory of another friend.
Yes, Hannah, we could have let them talk all day. But beyond that, this is a reminder of why, as Lise said, journalism and journalists matter.
And that lies at the heart of our Behind the Headlines conversations, where each episode we're privileged to hear from colleagues.
So we hope you've enjoyed this first podcast, whatever platform you're looking on. Please do come to us again. Please do share it with friends and come back next time. We'll be back very soon. Hannah, who have we got next up?
We're delighted to be speaking to Bryony Gordon, journalist and mental health campaigner, and she's going to be talking to us about her new book, No Such Thing as Normal.